This is Steve Factor. Welcome to the McFuture podcast and part two of an episode I haven't given a name yet. I am going to talk about a conspiracy. I love using the word conspiracy, but I don't actually believe in most conspiracies. But there is a second layer to all of the free speech stuff I talked about in the previous episode. We have a deeper game that's being played, and I don't think a lot of people think about it or even clued into it. But once you start to ponder, it starts to look like a conspiracy. And you can tell there's a conspiracy theorist in the room whenever they start using the word they. I'm going to slip into it here and there, but I'm going to try to avoid it. Just know that I think in general, when you have a lot of very powerful people defending their self-interest over long periods of time, it starts to look like a conspiracy, especially in retrospect, because, you know, it leads society in a certain direction. The reason I made the case for free speech in the last episode is that we're in the midst of a much deeper struggle of misinformation. And there are at least four main types. The first three I'm not going to cover in a lot of detail, and I'll explain why. The first one is foreign interference. So there's a lot of people talking about disinformation and Russia ads, and now China's getting in on it, you know, because they see how easy we are to trigger. So they're all taking advantage of it, and they're putting all these inflammatory ads out there and all kinds of stuff. They want to use any sort of wedge, whether it's race or gender or sex, all of the stuff that we're fighting around and giving them the opportunity to separate us. Their whole goal is to divide and conquer. They can't destroy us with weapons or their crappy militaries. And, you know, China's improving, but still, they can't beat us violently. They can't even beat us necessarily economically, but they can let us do the job for them. And we are more than happy to do it. And at the same time, they're introducing little bits and pieces of their agenda. They want to weaken sanctions against them, like Russia especially. They want to weaken NATO because NATO is a force against China and Russia potentially. China, they want tariffs to drop. They want to keep dumping their goods on us. They want us to destroy each other, but also let them make money. And Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, they're amplifying this. They're amplifying the polarization because the algorithms are all for engagement. The reason I'm not going to focus a ton of energy on this is because it's boring. It's just obvious what needs to be done. This is a policing matter. This is something the FBI and CIA and all the other acronyms of government have to get involved with and work with the social networks to try to root out. And this is par for the course. We do it. They're going to do it. Everyone's going to try to do disinformation to put their agenda forward. So we just have to learn to deal with it and educate ourselves. I don't think there's anything interesting for me to add to that. The second type is trolling. I think a lot of people mistake right and left-wing lunatics as people who hold these deep philosophical political positions. I think a lot of them are just shitsters. They just want to make memes, especially the right-wing guys. Like you go to Gab. By the way, when I say go to Gab, don't go to Gab. you're going to be depressed for hours. They just want to go against whatever the establishment thinks. So it's a lot of young guys on YouTube or Reddit or 4chan or 8chan or 16chan or all the chans. And any one of these guys in real life would panic, orgasm, and run if he ever saw a real girl within 100 yards. So these people are not some tough, organized militia or anything else. These are just, they're shit posters and they're trolls. So I really don't worry about them. They are going to exist no matter what. And again, you have to deal with it. Or the platforms need to decide we're not going to be anonymous anymore. We're not going to let people create anonymous accounts, which is a business decision. And maybe that identity doesn't have to be made public, but at least they have to know who you are. So that's something we can debate. I don't have a strong opinion on that because I do think that produces higher quality discourse, but it also risks exposing people who are in tough situations and may not be able to speak freely. So I see both sides. Anyway, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. The next one, this one's a little trickier. Conservatives. I'm not going to excuse conservatives here because they've been pretty effective in pumping out half-truths. Like when Obama was president, they had the birther conspiracies and they had a whole bunch of fear-mongering from Fox News. They still do it. Oh my God, look at all the Hispanics marching in. And I get it. It gets my mom and dad all riled up because they're sitting there, they're old, they're retired, they're watching this stuff. And meanwhile, they barely leave the house. I don't know how Mexicans or Muslims are scary to my parents or anyone else in that age group. People are unhappy generally when power switches from one side to the other. So it creates an opportunity to stir up your base, get them all fearful and pumped up to reelect you. It's a game, but this game has consequences. And now I think there's been an escalation. MSNBC, you know, they've been talking about Russia conspiracy theories. And then when the report comes out, they're like, have you heard about the Ukraine? Now it's all Ukraine in the membrane. I wonder if people are even paying attention at this point. You know, there's only so many conspiracy theories and talking heads who know nothing that you could throw at people before they just completely tune out and think you're full of shit. Also, these are entertainment platforms, so we're not really seeing news anymore. So if you're still watching this stuff, you're better off watching sitcoms. The reason I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about conservatives, and this is controversial because I know a lot of people feel differently, so I welcome your counterpoints, but I just don't see them as a long-term threat, even when their rhetoric is horrible. And here's why. I think their numbers are waning. I think if you look at aging among conservatives, they're getting older. Racially, the country is changing, so they're going to be increasingly in the minority. Urbanization is happening, and once people move to cities, they become much more liberal and for some reason enjoy avocado toast. No one can explain it, but that's just how it is. If you see growth of avocado consumption, you'll see that things are not going in the conservative direction. And conservatives don't control the media. And I know this is one of these weird talking points that everyone uses to bash each other over the head with, but that's just the reality. Conservatives don't go into media. They just don't. They go into finance. They go into all these other professions to make money. Most of them don't want to be artists. And everyone watching Fox News is in a hospice. They're so old. That network should come with an IV. They should be running a drip from their studio to every retirement home in the country. They have just a handful of personalities and outlets that you've heard of. So you know exactly who to monitor. There's not a whole bunch of like new conservatives popping up everywhere. They're just older and so they're less online. And even on social media, conservatives are not that impressive. They're not as creative. They're kind of reactionary. They're sort of like scavengers, you know, they'll swoop in whenever someone on the left screws up and they're trying to mimic the tactics of the left, but it's always a little bit lackluster and they don't have the numbers to sustain the virality. They don't have young people constantly clicking online. Yeah, sometimes the trolls jump in to help just because they're trolls and that's what they do. So the only place they get a little bit of an advantage is because there's so few outlets and so few conservative pundits compared to the left. They're likelier to get the attention of politicians, especially Trump. And their tactics are kind of predictable. They only have a few tricks left up their sleeve. Yes, they're trying to do voter suppression. When I say suppression, yeah, maybe it is suppression. I don't know. But they're trying to get fewer people who disagree with them voting. So they want to raise the bar. And voter ID is not an unreasonable thing to ask. But yes, the result is fewer people who disagree with them vote. And gerrymandering and campaign donations, all this stuff, even that's not working for them anymore. Because if you look at the companies that are powerful in red states, oil and manufacturing and all these traditional companies, they're losing all their mojo to the cosmopolitan companies that are in cities, companies that are in tech. That's where all the money is. So the money is bleeding out. The money and the power is bleeding out from red state companies into blue state companies that are in cities. And so they've got this sort of desperation going on. They're structurally disadvantaged. Until they start attracting a bunch of new people from all walks of life in every group, Black, Hispanic, and so on, they're not a threat. They're a predictable adversary, which is very different. So when people get all up in arms about the alt-right and all of these other hateful people that can be classified as right-wing, I'm not worried. Because their fringe and their numbers are tiny. Until that changes, and it might, but I doubt it, I don't see the right wing as a huge threat because it's not a huge magnet the way liberals are. So that brings me to the fourth source of disinformation. And this is where I think the bulk of the problem is. And it's social media, primarily dominated by the left. And I'll explain. As all things horrible, it starts with someone trying to save a bunch of money. All of these online rags, you know, the HuffPos and the Mikes and the, I don't know, what are the other ones? That is Salon, BuzzFeed, of course. They hire a bunch of college kids fresh from Antifa rallies. They have no job experience and they're full of idealism, which is great. You know, I'd love to be idealistic again, except I'm not. I'm a horrible, scorned adult who sees the darkness in the world. But I still see a little bit of light. That's why I do this stuff, because I think there is a better way. And these people want to change the world by YouTubing. So, I mean, listen, you got to keep all these things in perspective, right? Look, I get the impulse, but it also kicks off this atrocious, toxic cycle of media. So Vox and Vice and Intercept and HuffPo and all these other places are just pumping this stuff out. It's full of like idealism and name calling and all the evil people that are wronging the world and raping our resources, all this stuff. And you know, there's some validity to some of their grievances, but most of this stuff is so wild and out there because it's coming from people who haven't experienced life, who haven't been anywhere near the groups they're supposedly interested in defending, who are racked with guilt over their own privilege and their ability to go to some crazy expensive school just so they can work for almost free to pump out this information. But what is this information? It's disinformation. Underneath all of these articles is a pseudoscience industrial complex, basically activism disguised as science. All of the untested theories from academia, if deleted today, would never, ever come back like real sciences would. Like if you deleted everything, chemistry, physics, biology, math, all of the hard sciences, if you deleted all of our knowledge, in about 1,000 years, we'd have all of it back. If you delete all the intersectional victim theories, good luck finding those in 1,000 years. At this point, all of these studies are like Bible passages. Everyone can find one to support whatever they think the truth should be. And then dumb celebrities and influencers pile in, so they amplify it. Like Alyssa Milano, one of the most privileged people on earth who lives in the hills of Hollywood. You know, she's incredibly oppressed and she's going to tell you about it. Look, she's got a lot of guilt. She reads these articles. Everyone seems to be oppressed. Everything's systemic. And when you don't have to interact with real people who are struggling, you take on the struggles of the world in a very clean way that's visible to everybody, but ultimately worthless. Because you're not actually helping somebody. And I don't want to isolate her. She's just a symptom of a much bigger problem. And then mainstream media picks it up because, hey, if Alyssa Milano is talking about it, this must be news. And they legitimize it. They amplify it. They bring it to the masses and treat this tiny group of malcontents as if it's real. And by the way, they do the same exact thing with Trump tweets. At least he's president. She's self-appointed. She's president of outrage. Oh, that should be a new cabinet position. Secretary of Poutrage. That's going to be awesome. I bet you the next Democrat administration is going to have that. So now we're all debating pseudoscience that was pumped out by a bunch of teenagers and amplified by Alyssa Milano at scale. These are America's priorities now. So now, of course, politicians get involved. Those whores, they just run to the cameras as soon as those lights go on. And it creates pressure for action. And that's the next and the scariest step, which is manifestation. That's where all of these bad ideas come to life and start actually affecting people. And in some cases, it's positive. You'll have some very bad people caught by the Me Too movement who were abusive and should be punished. But then you also have a bunch of other people being punished solely based on accusations with no due process. They get mobbed out of jobs, fired, kicked off social media. A bunch of speakers get banned from speaking at universities. Reputations that took a lifetime to build suddenly get ruined in a second. And then the most insidious part of it is all the people who don't speak up, all the research that's no longer done. People are now avoiding entire subjects that are important, biology, math, and hard sciences, we're never going to see because they've been intimidated and there's no way they're going to fight the mobs or risk the possibility of being mobbed. They've got families and mistresses to support. I'm just kidding. Some, I presume, are good people. And also corporate rules are being changed and bills are being passed, all based on fraudulence, all based on misguided idealism. And this process, this vicious circle, is creating a level of permanence and a level of disruption never seen before. I'm going to put out this graphic at some point. Now let's talk about all the players in this game, some of which I haven't mentioned yet. And that's where some of the semi-conspiratorial stuff comes in. When you look at all the players, at the root of most of what they're doing is some form of power. And I'll explain. So if you look at these radical professors, they're really activists disguised as intellectuals. And these guys have been concocting oppression and socialist theories and all kinds of craziness for ages, and nobody cared. No one read anything they published. I think at some point they put out the average readership for every research paper. I think it was something like half of 1% of academic papers actually got read. It was something that ridiculous. And now that there's all of these publications that are willing to give airtime to their ridiculous ideas, these guys could not be happier. The only power they wanted when they went into academia is to matter, to feel important, to have their ideas count. Because academia is all about ideas. You don't build anything. Now, here's the irony. Capitalists open the door for these people to matter. This collective greed and self-interest created a lot of cronyism, lobbying and buying off of politicians and not taking care of people who've fallen through the cracks. So they've opened the door to Marxist-type ideologies. And Marx, by the way, everyone should read Marx, whether you're on the right or on the left. You need to understand the theories. And Marx was brilliant. He was right on the money in terms of his diagnosis. It's his solutions that are terrible. Anyone who's ever tried to apply Marxist theory, it's led to authoritarianism, tens of millions of deaths in China and Russia under Stalin and Mao, oppression everywhere. It's all about control. It's all about forced equality and corruption. But the corruption just doesn't happen to be in the private sector, it's in the public sector. My own family, we escaped from the Soviet Union. It was a disaster. There were lines for toilet paper. I remember as a kid learning how to wipe my ass with newspaper. And the trick, by the way, in case you're ever in a tight spot, is to take the newspaper and crumple it up many, many times. Open it, crumple it, until it becomes sort of soft. And then it becomes just as good as Charmin. I did this. I lived this. This is real. So the people who are pushing this, they're not liberals. They're not liberal-minded. I'm a liberal. I want everyone to be able to do what they want. These are utopianists who think that they can impose a utopia on the world. But one man's utopia is another's worst nightmare. And that involves a lot of control, because you don't breed competition out of people through laws. People are still going to, some people are going to try, some people are going to laze around, and some people just don't have the ability. And that's just life. And so the first phase of control, and this has been established in all kinds of strategies for radicalism, Saul Alinsky and all these other people, is you control the language first. Think of all the new terms that have been introduced over the last, 5 years or so. Cis, patriarchy, mansplaining, manspreading, white privilege, all these gender pronouns. They're used to delegitimize people by labeling them as a bigot, as insensitive, as a racist. And then you can dismiss that person wholesale. You can take them out of circulation completely. In a way, it's kind of the opposite of what drug companies do, because drug companies, they medicalize a bunch of symptoms, so they convince you you have an ailment, right? And then they want to sell you the cure. So it's like, oh, now you've got restless leg syndrome, something that didn't exist ever. And then, oh, you have sex addiction or ADHD and all this other stuff. And some of these things exist in some small capacity. But at the end of the day, they're like, oh, here's your Ritalin. Here's your antidepressant drugs. Here's your Claritin. All of this stuff is concocted to sell drugs, but in this case, to take power. The difference, of course, is what the drug companies are doing are way better, because you have a choice whether to buy it or not. But here, you don't have a choice. When you're sentenced to someone else's label as a bigot or something else, you're shackled with it. There's no due process. No one's looking out for you being scorned by friends and family once you're tagged with something. Your agency in the world, your legitimacy, and your living can be taken away just like that. All right, that was the worst snap in the world, like that. And these are products of a radical belief system that's taken hold in universities, which, you know, we were perfectly willing to put up with when no one read those papers. But now it's being used to create a utopia, a very controlled totalitarian utopia that I don't think even the people pushing for it will want. Because to create equality of outcomes requires unbelievable force. You have no idea what it takes to make people at the bottom equal to the people at the top. It is going to be bloody and painful if it ever comes to fruition. Now, the other people involved here, activist bloggers, a lot of them are disgruntled, overeducated idealists who went to top schools and have affluent families, or at the very least have families whose money they are willing to disrespect by going into a very low paying profession. So they're getting to follow their passion, but they're harboring a lot of grievances and also very naive notions of what's just and who's guilty and who isn't guilty. They're professional victims in law. So they're not the actual victims. They are victims in law. They have anointed themselves protectors of people who didn't ask for their help and who are helped not at all by their tweets or any of their methods. They want to change the world for people they see as being wronged, which is not a bad impulse, but they're coming at it from a very ill-informed perspective. And I'm sure they'd all disagree with me. In fact, they're probably already trying to cancel me. But they're the verified alphas of the beta community. They're seeking status. This is the classic battle between intellectuals and business people. The overeducated elite, they do all right in life, but they always have this undercurrent of jealousy and resentment. They're like, well, I'm so much smarter. I have so much more education. Why are my ideas not running the world? And why are all these scruffy, dumb grunts making exponentially more than I am? And I wrote a whole piece on that. Just go to ideafactory.com/success. But these people were betas in every other aspect of their lives. But finally here, The losers are the winners. They're playing a game of Dungeons and Dragons that they can win. And they're playing a very cynical game because no one's actually offended. And the way you can tell the difference between outrage and poutrage, poutrage is a word that looks better in print than when you say it. People who are genuinely outraged are usually directly impacted. The families, the people who know them, the people who work with them. And they dedicate significant future resources to that issue. Everyone I know who's had a close relative or friend die of a certain disease, a lot of them commit to fundraising or raising awareness or marching for that cause. Same thing with victims of shooting, but not the victims in law. And the way you can tell, he or she moves on to grandstand on the next controversy within the next hour. All right, people, I've tweeted out where everyone is wrong and I'm right. Now you go take care of that shit because I've got to get Roseanne fired. I am a very busy person. That's how they think. And as a guy, if you hear a guy say that he's offended, what is going on? And I know, Steve, who are you to define what a man is? Traditional masculinity is oppressive. You don't get to say, yes, you're right. You're right. I don't get to define it. Doesn't mean I have any more respect for the person, the man who says I am offended. Sorry, I refuse to accept the word offended. If you're constantly offended, or if you're busy coloring in protest signs, or if you're wearing a pussy hat, or we're sewing one together, or you're blogging about being an ally, no woman will have sex with you. I guarantee it. So the test isn't me, some barbarian clod with a podcast. It's women. No one is respecting you if you walk around saying you're offended. Most of the time, it's cynical and you're not really offended, or you're using it because, hey, a lot of cute girls attend protests. Just suck it up. Be nice to people. That's all it takes. You don't have to put on a big pink pussy hat and march around. You don't have to. You could just be a good guy, not a fake nice guy. And that's an important distinction. A lot of these guys raging on social media, there's a certain anger to them, which isn't that different from the trolls and the incels. Be really careful with self-proclaimed do-gooders. Deep down, I don't think nice guys are good guys, because they expect something in return. They expect a certain outcome, or a girl to like them, or to get some sort of adulation online. I don't think they're real. I think they're phonies. This whole thing from these activist bloggers is an ends justify the means kind of strategy. And you could tell by the tactics that they use. So I mentioned sticking labels on people. They're not just sticking labels on any old person who says something against them. They want people who are successful and effective, people who make valid points, people who've attracted a passionate audience, and those are the ones they're trying to take down. This is extremely strategic. A perfect example is what happened with Majid Nawaz. So Majid Nawaz was a pro-Muslim activist until he became an anti-extremism activist. But that didn't stop the SPLC, which used to be a very reputable organization, but now has taken on this woke cloak, and they labeled him an anti-Islamic extremist. He won $3.4 million against them in a defamation suit. And these guys are doing the same thing to a bunch of other people who I've personally heard and are not at all what they're being represented to be. Because I've heard them. I want to hear from myself. Just like I want to read Karl Marx, I want to hear every single one of these people. The Alex Joneses, the Gavin McInneses, all these people. And when you listen to them, yeah, sometimes they're jerks. Sometimes they're insensitive. Sometimes they represent ideas that you find unsavory or just plain wrong. But very rarely are they the monsters that match the labels. The second tactic they use is stripping out all context and purposefully misreading people's intentions so they can just isolate the words they need to take someone down. It's really malicious and dark. A perfect example is what they did to Joe Biden. Now, Joe Biden went out there and basically said, hey, if I could work with segregationists, I can reach compromise with anybody. Oh, no, 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 Joe. You think you're going to get away with that? No, you are a white supremacist, my friend, because you just praised white supremacists. That is unbelievable to me that that became a narrative, because that's not at all what he said. And when you're busy canceling people like Al Franken and Sarah Silverman, people who are clearly trying to do their best, you are a malicious prick, extracting little bits of information out of context, pretending to be stupid just to strip people of their livelihood, just because they're successful and you're not. That makes you horrible. The third tactic they use is anecdotalism. With everyone running around with cameras and all kinds of access to information now, you can construct any narrative you want. And just because you can do it and collect a bunch of anecdotes and videos to do it doesn't make it true. It just means you made a very effective compilation. You could make a compilation of 1,000 porn videos and say, hey, Americans are all porn stars. It wouldn't be true, but you'd certainly have a lot of material. Remember when that right-wing congressman walked in with a snowball to Congress and said, look, how can there be global warming when I'm holding a snowball? And everyone's like, oh, look at this idiot. That's exactly what's being done right now. It just disguised as intellectualism. Just because you're able to isolate a bunch of anecdotes or videos into a storyline doesn't make it any more true. Not statistically speaking. And no one is looking at the stats. For example, we're less violent than we ever have been. We're less racist than we ever have been. More people are in interracial relationships than ever. We are living in a time of incredible progress. Not if you listen to the woke cynics. And the fourth tactic is just as devious, which is judging all things that have ever happened to anybody ever through today's lens and through today's woke ideology. Who's going to be able to stand up to that? There's nobody. If you try hard enough, you can take anyone down by applying standards that didn't exist in the past. And Bill Maher did a brilliant, brilliant breakdown of this. Here's a short clip.
People need to stop pretending that if they were alive back when, they wouldn't have been the same asshole as everyone else. Yes, you would. I know your parents told you you're exceptional, but not to the point of seeing the future. You would have driven without seatbelts and drank when you were pregnant and hit your kids and hit your neighbor's kids. They did that shit. Yeah, it's a member of the neighbor. Because woke sight is not 2020. And you don't have ESPCP. Extrasensory politically correct perception. If you were around in the 1980s, you would have worn those horrible colors and the big shoulder pads. You just would have. You're not Nostradamus. And if you were around in the 1780s and you were rich and white, you likely would have had slaves. The first abolition society in America was founded in 1775, and it had 24 members. 24 people in the whole country thought slavery was wrong the year before we declared independence. Stop being surprised we used to be dumber than we are now. The humans of tomorrow will be horrified by us. They won't believe we used to sexualize people during sex. Millennials seem to think they came along right as society met perfection. Do you really think future generations will look at what you're doing? The man buns and the... the giant, stupid, ear-stretching earrings and say, that was the moment civilization peaked. We can add nothing more. No. You're not morally better than your grandparents. You just came later. You're just the next upgrade. You're the iPhone 11.
I'll link to the full segment in the show notes. If these wokies had any technical skill at all, this would be the thing to motivate them to build a time machine so they can go back in time and cancel George Washington and Lincoln and all the people that built the country and everything that did not conform. Why don't we just pretend the time machine was invented and take all of the paintings down that are in every museum? Clearly, those people are not enlightened and used all the wrong pronouns. Let's take down everything in your house that was invented by a douchebag. We need to get rid of it. Let's get rid of everything. Everything. Your computer. I'm sure a misogynist invented a hard drive. RAM. Get rid of all of it. It's all gone. Nothing. Have nothing. I want to have a huge cancellation ceremony. Let's find all of the cemeteries that have all the famous people and inventors and dig them all up, put them all in the pile, burn them, and then bury them again upside down so you can humiliate them even in their death. You know how they have that coffee? I think it's called Kona, where the monkeys eat the beans and then they shit them out and then rich white people drink it. I think that's what we should do with all these corpses. We burn them up. We feed the ashes to monkeys. When the monkeys crap them out, then a bunch of super woke people eat them. They crap them out. And then we bury whatever comes out. I mean, what could be more shameful? And what could be a better use of our time? I can't think of anything. So what these guys are actually doing, the Daily Beast, Salon, or Outline, all these outlets, they themselves know they don't have the power to change things. But what they're doing is they are weaponizing other people's trauma or self-resentment or dissatisfaction with life. And they're profiting from it. There's this guy, Anand, starts with a G, Girihirdas. I'm butchering his name. But he... At first, you know, I saw a video of his and he made sense about the diagnosis of what's going on. Yeah, I agree with a lot of it. I started following him and the more I saw of his posts, the more I realized he's just a grievance profiteer. And he's not alone. There's tons of these people. But he is a person who is giving the mob red meat, exactly what they want. Enjoy your moment in the sun, buddy. I see you for what you are. That was a personal message to Anand in case he's listening. But people like him are seeking political power. They're seeking validation and they're seeking profit. All of these guys are actually upholding the establishment because they're silencing these independent voices and these outliers, cutting out all the fringes that don't fit. And right now, a lot of the fringes on the right, but they're going to be cut just like everybody else. So this is the part I re-recorded a couple of times because I call the mob useful idiots. And at first I was like, well, you know, that's very condescending and maybe I should change that. But I think it's the right term and I realize it's insensitivity. But I think there are a lot of people who are giving in to their worst impulses. They're externalizing some of the guilt they feel about maybe not achieving everything they could, or their own fragility or depression or rage at the world, and they're weaponizing it against other people. I think there are a lot of people who are struggling for purpose. They're desperate to belong, and Twitter becomes their family. More often than not, I feel sorry for them. You know how bouncers at the club seem to get off on keeping you out. Maybe that is the only control that he has in his life. Maybe everything else has gone to shit. All of these people, rather than being creators of value, they become correctors of words and reactionaries. And they're turning every dumb Trump tweet or celebrity flub into a diversion. They're feeding something that doesn't matter. And that ultimately destroys our freedoms. That's what makes them useful idiots. And I'm including celebrities in all of this. These are people who would have been waiters if some lucky break didn't happen. You know, I want to feel compassion for people like Rosanna Arquette. This is her exact tweet that she posted. "I'm sorry I was born white and privileged. It disgusts me. And I feel so much shame." Rosanna, someone needs to give you a hug. It's not going to be me because I'm not climbing over your security fence. But find somebody. Get a puppy. Make it a rescue. Tell them you ran into the burning building to get it. There's no reason to hate yourself. There's no reason to overcompensate. There are people who struggle, but we can't do it on a group level. We need to treat people as individuals. And look, you can't discount stupid and crazy. There's still plenty of that. I am going with stupid first. I'm going to make a bumper sticker. I'm going to sell that to you people because I think you people, I did not mean anything by it. Please don't cancel me. Anyway, if you think words are violence, you're either stupid or a liar. If you think punching someone because someone else labeled them a bigot or a Nazi, you think that's okay? It is unprincipled. It's hypocritical. But more than anything, it is stupid. When you're screaming wildly at someone who disagrees with you, yes, you might be right in some cases, but you might also be stupid and crazy. And I think a lot of it is growing pains. We need to learn how to use these tools, and the tools themselves have to be better. So what's the establishment media up to, huh? What's in it for them? First of all, news hasn't been news in a long time. It's been entertainment. No one's out for truth. No one's out there going through the garbage cans of people that are under suspicion. All of the people you see on these shows, they have a role to play. They're puppets. They're the same thing you would see in a Shakespearean era play. Our version of it is, here's the conservative, here's the triggered student, here's the wacky next door neighbor who's brought on this show to go at it to get engagement and clicks and to get people sharing it. De-escalation is not on the menu. The profit lies in the conflict, not in the resolution. Why do you think Arafat didn't take the Israeli offer to revert Palestine to the 1967 borders? Conflict was his gravy train. That's what got him all those riches that he pilfered from the Palestinian people. It's the same reason drug companies don't want cures. They want treatments. Treatments people pay for forever. You can never trust anyone that benefits from perpetuity. Think about those words. Especially if the thing they're perpetuating is of questionable value. More important than money is long-term survival, and that comes from corporate advertising. Mainstream media companies are the main beneficiaries of our broken campaign finance system. So the more money lobbyists give to Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or Donald Trump or anyone else, every penny is going into advertising. It's going into TV commercials. So the older demographic, they'll pump all their money into Fox News and all of the things that skew older. And a lot of the left wingers will take all that lobbyist money and they'll pump it into social media and more digital stuff where their people are likelier to be. Together, this gives mainstream media an incentive to preserve their influence. So they want certain narratives. You will never hear a debate question about campaign finance reform, not from a mainstream network. That's their bread and butter. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars transferred from billionaires to politicians to media companies for ads. It is insanity. So this is survival for them. They need to keep this two-sided equation going. On one side, the advertisers, and on the other side, the people who they need clicking in order to keep getting the advertising. Until you're paying for media, and that media only serves you, you have to approach it with extreme skepticism. So it's in their interest to get all of these independent channels banned or acquire them. It's a battle between large and small, mainstream and alternative. They're in the process of cutting off or acquiring all the voices that disagree with them or threaten their viability. The social networks, they're a little bit different because I think their employee base is kind of woke. So are the audiences they want to keep or appease. So at the very least, the front end has to look super progressive. Deep down in the guts, they are cold, heartless capitalists. It's a great cloak. And Professor Scott Galloway talks about this a lot. He's an NYU professor and a pundit. He talks about how wokeism is a great disguise. And if you look at Google and the complexity of what goes on in their organization, you start to understand all of the competing interests that are at play here. Google gave a bunch of money, Eric Schmidt in particular, and resources to Hillary Clinton. They built up her digital infrastructure, maybe not the email system, I don't know. So they do have a vested interest in preserving status quo. And Hillary Clinton was the status quo choice in that election against Bernie and then also against Trump. At the same time, they're allowing the left to take control of their standards and what is banned and what isn't banned. You look a little bit deeper and you find that they're applying their rules very differently to people who make them a lot of money. And these are quotes from YouTube employees who talk about people like Logan Paul, Steven Crowder, PewDiePie. These are super popular personalities on their platform and they get a little bit more lenient punishments because end of the day, it's a business. Always will be. So all of this stuff they put out there is posturing. And internally, they've got all kinds of crazy. I'm not going to go into all the details. I wrote a lot of notes. But they've got internal memos that call Ben Shapiro and Dennis Prager Nazis. Like just memos between employees. Ben Shapiro wears a yarmulke. He's a Jew. So is Dennis Prager. I mean, the insanity of this stuff just going unquestioned. And these employees are protesting the company for being misogynist. And, you know, they might have some points there because they've paid off some people who, I don't know if they were abusive to women in the company or they were having sex and making advances. I don't know. There's a bunch of people who were paid off. It's this weird situation where the very company that defines our truth, the first thing we do is Google to find answers, is also the most politicized internally. Originally, they had all these forums internally where people can debate stuff. And this guy, James Damore, who ended up getting fired because he took it literally. People in corporate will say they want to listen to your ideas up until the point it creates a distraction or threatens their ability to earn money. Then you're out. Whether you're protesting for something just or writing crazy memos, you are a dead man or woman walking once you go against the financial interests of the company you're with, whether it's Google or anybody else. Google just recently tried to change their policy so employees talk about politics less. I'm not sure they're going to be able to put that genie back in the bottle. Cultures are very hard to change. The last thing I want to mention about Google, as sort of a representation of social media companies, is this clip from a testimony from the publisher, or I think he's the editor of Psychology Today. This is what he said to Congress.
You testified before this committee that Google's manipulation of votes gave at least 2.6 million additional votes to Hillary Clinton in the year 2016. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I want to make sure I understand, you personally supported and voted for Hillary Clinton.
I was a very strong public supporter of Hillary Clinton, yes.
Your testimony is that Google is, through bias in search results, manipulating voters in a way they're not aware of.
On a massive scale. In 2020, if all these companies are supporting the same candidate, there are 15 million votes on the line that can be shifted without people's knowledge and without leaving a paper trail for authorities to trace. If on election day in 2016, if Mark Zuckerberg, for example, had chosen to send out a go vote reminder, say just to Democrats, and no one would have known if he had done this, that would have given that day an additional at least 450,000 votes to Democrats. And we know this without doubt because of Facebook's own published data, because they did an experiment that they didn't tell anyone about during the 2010 election. They published it in 2012. It had 60 million Facebook users involved. They sent out a go vote reminder, and they got something like 360,000 more people to get off their sofas and go vote who otherwise would have stayed home. And in 2020, you can bet that all of these companies are going to go all out. And the methods that they're using are invisible. They're subliminal. They're more powerful than most any effects I've ever seen in the behavioral sciences. And I've been in the behavioral sciences for almost 40 years.
This power that social networks have is unbelievable and also undetectable. I'll include the link to the full testimony in the show notes. Okay, let's talk about politicians, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them. What they want is pretty transparent. They want money and they want votes, and that's it. But they're also really dangerous laggards. Very few of them lead. You even look at Obama, who's considered to be a great leader by some. He didn't lead on gay marriage. He was a laggard. He waited to see where the winds were going to blow, and he went there. Same thing with single payer. He didn't fight for that. I don't even know if he believed in that. These are not leaders. And call me cynical, but if you think Trump or Bernie or any of these guys are going to save you, you are so screwed. And I've said that before, which is also kind of ironic because those two guys in particular are the few that are actually leading. They're just leading with really bad ideas. And Bernie, you know, he commandeered that entire 99% movement. Bernie Sanders has fresh ideas from 1960s Cuba and a tuna sandwich. It is on white bread. Bernie Sanders considered brown bread and focaccia. Focaccia, this is too fancy for Bernie Sanders. Unless his book is a bestseller, then you can take your dirty piercings off my lawn, you dirty, dirty hippies.
Anyway, I love Bernie and I'm going to miss him. My only impression. I just wish his ideas were up to date because he's realistically the only threat to the establishment, to the extent that an old man on his last legs can be a threat to the establishment. But it's not so much him, it's the ideas that he's planting into young, impressionable minds who haven't lived through socialism's greatest hits, which is people like me who had to escape socialism to have a chance to succeed in life. All right, now we're getting to the good stuff. I'm talking about the level two game, the apex of this pyramid. The establishment elites. Pretty much everyone I've talked about so far is a chump, a tool, a pawn. And it's not always clear who is and who isn't. Some people make the mistake of thinking these media hacks or influencers matter. They don't. As I mentioned in the influencer episode, which you should check out, most of the people with real power and influence have never touched a computer. We're their dancing monkeys. If you're in media, they're letting you exist because the minute you embrace a narrative that they're not comfortable with, that threatens them or their livelihood or their future in some capacity, they'll take your career in a second. Ooh, that snap was pretty good. And this is not some sort of conspiracy theory. They're just people you've never heard of or rubbed elbows with. They exist in a universe most of us do not inhabit. And I'm talking about people who own media companies, huge magnates. I don't even know what that means, but it sounds like magnets and sounds cool. Anyone who's ever been filmed by Jeff Epstein or Putin for blackmail purposes, that's the kind of power broker I'm talking about. I'm talking about the billionaires who network at Davos. I'm talking about people who pay tens of thousands of dollars to attend TED, or I think it might be hundreds of thousands. This is how far out of it I am. I don't get those invitations. Bundlers and donors like Harvey Weinstein before all his stuff exploded. This guy would collect tens of millions of dollars, probably hundreds over the years for Democrats and Hillary specifically. All the people who fund think tanks, all the guys who fund PACs and super PACs. In case you don't know, those are political action committees, which are completely unaccountable money from special interest groups, and they can spend as much as they want on any campaign and then, of course, collect the favors after. People who pay $25,000 per plate for fundraisers for Trump or Hillary or Biden, just so those candidates can reassure them, hey, listen, nothing's going to change. Don't you worry. I'll make sure not a hair on your head is harmed, billionaire, boss, jefe. The people who put the entire concept of superdelegates together, just in case they needed to overthrow democracy if they didn't like the candidate. You look at what was going on with the Democratic Party. There was a whole class of people who could basically decide above any of the voters, all of the idiots in the hats. They're running around the convention floor thinking they're all empowered, waving flags. Ooh, look, I'm a super fan. Yeah, I love Hillary. Meanwhile, they're just dumb puppets on a string who could be vetoed in a second if the people with real power, the super delegates, said, not so much. Not this guy, which they kind of did last time. I'm also talking about anyone who's been on that pedo perv Epstein's plane more than once and flying to that pedo island to have sex with kids knows what's up. Those are power brokers. They exist above the law, above countries. The guy gave $3.5 million to the Clinton Foundation. He would pal around with Trump, although Trump, I don't think, was partaking in that stuff. He had his own stuff going on. They're all being filmed by different people just to make sure that somebody's got something on them. Anyway, this is a level no one ever sees. Even Jeff Bezos doesn't have that kind of control. Yeah, he's got the money, and because his company's public, he gets a lot of attention. But there's a whole bunch of people we just don't see. Even corporations don't have the powers we think they do. A lot of them are pawns for the shareholders, the real people pulling the strings. You're never going to know their names, but they cut big checks and they pull big strings. You can't imagine in your wildest dreams what one phone call from a person like this could do. It could give you $40 million for your new venture, or make that teenager that you slept with from Pedo Island disappear in a second. The things that could happen would blow your mind. And not to to talk about conspiracy theories about Epstein, but that guy, his only way out might have been to kill himself, or who knows. That's the thing. When you've got that kind of dirt on powerful people, you better tie up all your loose ends before they do it for you. On the surface, it all looks like they're just trying to keep their money and keep their political influence. But the game that they're playing at that level, it's not played along the lines that we are arguing about on social media. They don't care about your gender or your race, or your orientation. That is for chumps. We are chumps if we're spending time debating it. Yeah, there are definitely correlations with race and all kinds of other things, but the real color that matters is green. Their lives are so far removed from our world. They're not affected by any of these things, not by our rules. They can get on a plane and be citizens of another nation in 5 minutes. To tell them about inequality and all this other stuff, you might as well be telling them about extreme couponing. Mr. Buffett, if you go into A&P on Thursday night, you get 45 cents off every can of Goya beans. You stock up your cabinets, it'll be amazing. And the reason they fund all these charities, and I talked in more detail about this in the Billionaires episode, is, yes, partially ego, and partially absolution. It's like, hey, this is me absolving myself of all the guilt of being as rich as I've been able to get. But also a lot of PR. How could this good guy be bad? How could, you know, kindly little Warren Buffett or Tom Steyer or, you know, Koch brothers, I don't know, they didn't seem to catch the PR protection. But the biggest benefit of all these causes that they fund is distraction. What they're trying to do is maintain this balance between distraction and destruction. But it's not always in their power to control. The more distracted and polarized we get against each other, the more difficult it becomes to have sane conversation about inequality or economic power. And corporations love all this polarization too, because when there's gridlock, it favors business as usual. So the more polarized things get, the more of this internal infighting we have, the less we're talking about real things, which is economics, economic power. That is the only thing that matters. And then when you cast each other as like some biblical good versus evil, how the hell are you going to talk about any real issues when someone that you're talking to now is some devil? It's insanity. And these distractions, I think, are inching towards destruction. I'll explain that in a second. And, you know, when I say they, I don't really think it's conspiratorial, but I think all of the money that's involved breeds a certain conservatism. And when I say conservatism, I don't mean like left versus right bullshit. That's not what I'm talking about. I say conservatism is conservative in terms of how you live, conservative with your money and your behavior. And plenty of liberals live conservative lives. So what they're doing is, in effect, not through planning or meetings, but you know, maybe it's a little bit of that too, but they're shrinking the Overton window. And the Overton window is named after Joseph Overton, which talks about what is acceptable political discourse. And so they want to keep that window as narrow as possible, because once you start expanding it, you start talking about things that threaten their power. When you talk about media, there are certain things that will never be discussed. Like I mentioned earlier, campaign finance reform. That opens the window too wide, and that threatens these organizations. There's too much at stake. And sure, we see a lot of disproportionate rewards going to some of these billionaire guys, or like the sweetheart deal that Warren Buffett gets for rescuing Lehman. I mean, numbers that no one else could get. Same thing with Bezos buying space or space companies, or getting all these government contracts. Once you have wealth, it just breeds more wealth. But there's a narrative that goes along with it. And it's a narrative that you and I have to believe, but they really don't, because they're not operating by the same rules. And that narrative is the world is a meritocracy. Anyone can succeed. Global trade is great. Low taxes are good. Education, really important. And more than anything, they want your obedience. I caught myself. Let's put it this way. If we are obedient and we think a certain way and don't deviate too much, we stay within the Overton window, risk averted. But when we wander off, that's where we're exposed. That doesn't mean that there's going to be a whole meeting saying, uh-oh, Bernie or Steve Actor are saying something we don't like, let's snipe them down. But on an individual level, the conservatism within certain organizations will do the sniping for them. Or in this case, all of the useful idiots on social media will do the work for them. They're serving their needs, the people on social media, all these snipers, all these mobs. And you see that with celebrities. The minute any of them stray from the official narrative, they are smacked down instantly. Matt Damon says, well, you know, we got to have different responses for different severities. Boom, smack down. Mark Duplass, I think he said, hey, you know, if you're looking for a conservative to follow, check out Ben Shapiro. I met him. He seems like a genuinely nice guy. Boom, apology. Chris Pratt, I think he just wore a t-shirt with a Don't Tread on Me logo. And that guy had to be apologizing. I mean, this is what's going on. This is how the Overton window gets maintained. That's how everyone stays within their little authorized framework. And education reinforces it. I'm not saying it's conspiratorial, but that's just how it is. We need a bunch of good boys and girls. That's just how society has always worked. The problem is when we start running out of middle-class jobs and skilled labor jobs and things that keep people occupied and able to afford the things they need, then you start seeing the unrest. Then you start seeing people outside authorized parameters on the left, on the right, but also mostly independent. Another tool that is used by the super powerful are think tanks. So historically, that was a way for capitalists to counteract universities. Because let's face it, there's no conservatives in universities. So like, okay, how do we look like we're academic? So they put together and funded a bunch of think tanks. And they are there to disseminate their agendas, you know, like free trade, like Koch brothers are a perfect example. They fund tons of think tanks. They fund tons of media properties. And they make sure that their free trade agenda is represented. They make sure that they procure the right guests for the media properties that they support and all this other stuff. You have to toe their line. And they also fund certain universities, like I think it was George Mason University. Anyway, they create a way to intellectualize and provide ammo for their side because it's got charts. I mean, anything with a chart has to be true. How could anything with a chart be false? Come on, people, it's a chart. It has numbers on it. It has an X and a Y axis. That is amazing. That's got to be true. And media would pick up on it and report on it. And that's how a lot of information got fed to us. It's also done with studies the same way. Hey, coffee cures cancer yet again? It's a miracle. It's a miracle. How did they do it? Last week, chocolate cured cancer, and now coffee cures cancer. I barely have to change any of my habits to be completely cancer-free. It is amazing. Amazing. Think about it, people. This is how it all gets maintained. And some of it is true. That's why it's so confusing. You can't point to any one thing and say it's untrue, but you got to pick and choose. And most of us are not equipped to pick and choose that well. And of course, there's lobbying and campaign finance. And, you know, all of that determines what the priorities are. Honestly, tell me that you believe climate change would be a priority to a mechanic living in Cleveland. Would that person come up with climate change as a priority? The people who own lots of things and have lots of capital and own corporations and property and beachfront and vacation homes and hotels, of course, they are the number one beneficiaries of the climate change narrative. That's not to say climate change isn't happening. It is. However, the people most interested in that narrative and the biggest beneficiaries of that narrative are also the ones who are financing it. So if I were to make my priority list of issues and the plumber from Cleveland made his list and a woman who teaches high school math in Texas somewhere, if we made our list of top priorities, I don't know that climate change would end up in the top five or maybe even top 10 for most people. So the things we end up debating are things that have been paid for as priorities for our politicians. And yes, and then we start running with it and arguing about it. So all of this stuff, all of these things that are dividing us, all these things that keep us fighting are distractions. They keep us from seeing the real game. And that real game is money, power, access, influence, real influence, not some douchebag who took a picture with a new purse on Instagram. And yes, there are some things that are good that can be accomplished at a superficial level using these level one charities and all this other stuff. But a lot of this stuff needs us to go deeper. But going deeper puts us up against real power and economic power. And Bernie's getting at that. I just don't like where he's going because he is not seeking to empower individuals. He's seeking to create another power structure of government that will become equally as corrupt. Already is. All of these tools, they're creating this very narrow window for us to operate in. It gives us fewer degrees of freedom. not just in terms of what we say, but in terms of how we live. You know, think of it like suburbs. The suburbs were conceived in the 50s. So you can drive to your manufacturing plant. So they all look the same all over the country. You've got your strip mall, your office park, and your house. And it's all driving all the time. That constrains physically your ability to do anything different. You can't walk to work. That's out of the question. You can't take public transit because it's all individual houses all spread out. It's not efficient to build. So you create a physical concept of a world that we're forced to live in. The same thing is happening conceptually, where a construct of a world is being dictated, not necessarily conspiratorially, but just through all of these different forces, and forces us to think within a certain framework. But it also now creates this power to unilaterally sideline us. Because if there's only five companies in a given industry, or two in some industries, or you say something publicly that's wrong, or unpopular, or pisses off someone in power, you can be completely discarded as an employee, as an earner, and basically as a citizen. And that's why I'm so adamant about maintaining individual freedom, about protecting it, because our last line of defense is speech. The other reason this is so important is innovation. Great art does not come from conformity. It doesn't come from a place of comfort. It challenges our norms. It upsets people. That's what makes it great. So innovation happens when the scope of ideas and the scope of dialogue expands, not when it contracts. And by contracting it the way we're doing now, we're sealing the fate on our future. We're limiting the number of possible futures we can have. And I made this whole case in the inevitability episode, the one with, what is it called? It's why even Musk can't trump the inevitable. You should listen to it. So we're limiting our number of possible futures. There's a whole bunch of inventions, artists, creatives, ideas we will never be exposed to because the window of acceptable speech and the window of acceptable behavior is narrowing. And it's narrowing quickly. So keep fighting over these divisive little snippy bullshit things. Keep fighting it. But you're doing the dirty work of closing that window, or at least making it narrower for all of us. And most people aren't going to process this the right way, or they don't care. They're comfortable living at level one. Great. But these things are breaking. Let's talk about that. I think in this balance between distraction and destruction, I think we might have permanently tipped towards destruction. And that's my greatest fear. We've normalized radicalization. We've taken something temporary, which is Donald Trump and some of his shitty rhetoric. And not to just isolate Trump, dissatisfaction has been brewing underneath the surface for a long time. He just happened to unleash it among his own supporters and people who are against him. And we're about to make the consequences of that permanent. This moment in history is creating so much cruelty, so much disdain for each other, that we're making it way too easy to dehumanize others. Not only that, but our systems and social media are rewarding it. And cruelty begets more cruelty. A lot of it is coming from normalizing public shaming. And here's what I mean by that. Every lefty and libertarian that I know pretty much agrees that our presence on foreign soil, especially in the Middle East, contributes to radicalization. It's not the only reason, but it's a contributor, right? And they'll never stop saying it unless their guy's in office. That's a different story. We all have our hypocrisies. But how would you feel if an omnipotent foreign army was stationed in Michigan and deposed and installed our leaders, or could rain bombs on us from drones in the sky at any moment? Do you know what that word and that feeling would be? Impotence, especially for men. Over a millennia, we've evolved all these muscles to provide for our families and defend our communities, to bring home the kebab. But now all these guys can't. They can't provide. They can't defend. They can't be men. Even their country isn't theirs without this foreign bodyguard that they don't know or trust. And we all seem to agree that's a shaming. So these people lash out, not all of them, but kill enough people with drones and the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon catches up with you pretty fast. It's the same kind of shaming that happened to Germany after World War I. The country was decimated. It was forced to pay reparations. It was plunged into depression. Men couldn't support their families. Money was worthless. Basic goods weren't available. Guess what happened next? A failed painter showed up, promising them greatness. Not food, not jobs, not better deals. Fucking greatness. And we all know what happened next, right? His Instagram followers exploded. And so did the rest of Europe. So what's today's shaming? Everything. Everything on social media. Everything. Imagine some guy whose life is going shitty, whose friends are numbing themselves with opioids or killing themselves at higher rates than ever. He might not have any hope of working ever again or going beyond stocking Walmart shelves. Imagine that guy turning on the news or going on Facebook and virtual occupying force rains bombs on him every day. Oh, look at your white privilege. Look at you're fat shaming somebody. Oh, look at everything you're doing. That quote you gave us, that was mansplaining. I know it was Wikipedia, but you're mansplaining. Now imagine 7 to 10 years of this bombardment over and over, nonstop. Constant reminders. Oh my God, look at all the privilege your skin affords you. And meanwhile, this guy still has only $80 in the bank. Suddenly, it's not inconceivable that this person lashes out and then finds others like him or votes in the fuck you candidate into office because that guy's going after other groups. So all of this stuff that's going on, we're self-radicalizing. And these guys on the right that we're beating up on on social media, they know where it's at. They know that their power, whatever power we think they have, they know the South isn't coming back. They know manufacturing jobs aren't coming back, no matter what Trump says. And white America is not coming back. You look at the stats. So they're flailing impotently at an America that doesn't need them anymore. And now we're adding fuel to the fire with all of the social media and the shaming and all this other stuff that goes on. And the same thing applies to Americans of all colors, races, creeds, sexual orientations. People who find themselves in poverty, in shitty jobs, broken homes, failing relationships. They're mired in hopelessness. And you know what? They tune in and they go online and Bill Maher is raging against climate change or some billionaire funded some campaign to raise your taxes to save the earth. Save the earth. Save me. Save me. Who is going to save me? That's what people are saying. And this applies to any group. And I know that shame isn't the only cause of this radicalization. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. But it's one we can control. We can choose to keep it dormant or we can activate it the way we've been doing it online. So escalation is inevitable. You can't have this kind of thing on one side and the other side not responding. You can't. You just can't. I'm not excusing it, but that's just how things work. Every force has an equal and opposite reaction. And you've seen the escalation, the Dayton shooter and the El Paso shooter. One was radicalized on the left, the other one on the right. The guy who ran over that poor woman at Charlottesville, Heather Heyer, she got killed by a crazed loon. This reporter, this gay Asian conservative reporter got beaten up, robbed, and milkshaked by Antifa at a rally in Portland. But that's not the worst of it. The worst of it was the cruelty of the people who were saying that he deserved it. And not some fringe anonymous people. I'm talking about bloggers and employees with 401k plans at places like BuzzFeed. I mean, I hope BuzzFeed doesn't have a 401k plan. Come on, it's a real shithole. That place really deserves to go out of business. But they're rationalizing the attack because it's okay, because this guy holds opinions that disagree with what we believe. That's dehumanization. And once you dehumanize people, you can rationalize anything. Anything at all. And we've seen it happen. We've seen it during the Holocaust. We've seen it during slavery. And the platforms we're using have dehumanization built in. These things don't convey tone or nuance or depth. They're shallow. There's no face-to-face. Yeah, occasionally someone puts up a video. But there's no mechanism for building empathy, for understanding where the other person is coming from. And you make it anonymous, that multiplies the effect, because now people have no social consequences. So they can be as trolling and horrible as possible. And honestly, that's one of the reasons I switched to primarily podcasting. I don't do as much writing anymore. I mean, I write out these ideas in an outline so I can do the podcast. But I don't think writing is a real way to communicate. I think it's inferior. And you know what? I think it deserves to die. And I know there have been great books, and it's great if you can delve deeply into a book, but you've seen the way people consume things now. They just scroll through a bunch of stuff and it's completely out of context. So you can see, oh, look, a disaster, murdered baby, oh, cute puppy, you know, and so like everything is jumbled up. Your brain is melding all these things together in this discordant feed. That's the irony of the feed. It doesn't feed us. It starves us. It starves us of our humanity. And as kooky as she is, Marianne Williamson, who's running for president, she's one of these motivational authors. And she, I think she officiated Liz Taylor's, one of her 40 weddings or whatever it is. And she made a good point during one of the debates. She said,
if you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days.
Wonkiness, which is, you know, a bunch of policy stuff, is inadequate to address the dark psychic force of collectivized hatred. She meant it in terms of Donald Trump and what he's bringing up in this country. And yes, that's true. He is definitely not helping. But the people responding aren't helping either. And in fact, the stats show it. And I pulled this from I forgot where this article's from, but I'll post a link in the notes. 42% of people in each party see the opposition as evil. These are actual surveys, by the way. 20% of Democrats and 16% of Republicans believe we'd be better off if the opposing party just died. they just died. I mean, that's the actual stat. And if the opposing party wins in 2020, 18% of Democrats and 13% of Republicans feel that violence would be justified. Can you imagine? And then there was another one that showed 86% of Republicans think Democrats are brainwashed. 84% think they're hateful. And 71% think they're racists. And Democrats were even worse. They were even more disdainful. 88% think Republicans are brainwashed. 87% think they're hateful. And 89% think they're racist. Think about that for a second. We live in a country where 89% of one party, let's say it's half the population, including people who lean that way, 89% of them think that the other people, the other 50% of the country, is racist. That's obscene. That is obscene. That is radicalization at work. And you can see it happening. You can see, you know, as insane as Trump's rhetoric is, you could almost discount him. But now, presidential candidates regularly, casually call him a white nationalist. He's a lot of things. The guy's a kleptocrat. The guy's maybe arguably corrupt. He's egotistical. He's incompetent. There's all kinds of things you can hurl at the guy. White nationalist? he's racist in the way that a country club out of touch guy would be racist, plus his ego, plus all kinds of other stuff. But think of the words we're just casually tossing around at each other. Climate change denier, racist, sexist, Nazi, fascist. You would think there'd be people being marched into ovens. Yes, there's some crazy stuff happening at the border. A lot of stuff that also happened under Obama, but didn't get as much coverage. But yes, we need to be accountable for that. We need to fix it. And we need to be diligent about it. And Republicans need to stand up about it. But the words just don't match the reality. They don't. And what happens with prolonged cruelty, and the same thing that happened with us in terms of our military, if you have enough military interventions, you attack enough countries, you authorize torture, you do all kinds of shady business and overthrowing governments, you lose your moral high ground. If you act this way and you throw around words like this that are genocidal words, you've lost all your moral high ground. It doesn't matter how good your cause is or how right you might be about climate or about social justice. It doesn't matter. You lose your moral high ground. It's gone. But the reason people are okay doing this, the real reason, is wokeism is now a religion. These bad ideas and the bad faith that goes along with them is being baked into this new American Puritanism. And it's just as zealous as any faith you've ever seen. It's even the words woke. I woke up and I saw the light and now I see all this evil around me that I have to oppress and shut down, even if it takes a totalitarian state to do it. But religions, which this is, are historically threats to state power. It's why the founding fathers here separated church and state. They wanted to make sure that politics and religion are separate because they saw what happened in Europe. The church became a power broker and one of the biggest landowners, actually the biggest landowner all over Europe. The Pope was a threat to the power of the state. The Inquisition was a flexing of power of the Catholic Church above and beyond the powers of the state to put down heretics and non-believers and oppress anyone else who opposed them. The supernatural is a tool that kings and congresspeople don't have at their disposal, even though some have tried to tap into it. Religion was banned in the Soviet Union under communism, where my family escaped and I escaped from, because it's a threat to state power. China has this group called Falun Gong. People who adhere to that faith are sentenced to labor camps. They're starved, they're beaten, they're tortured with electric batons because they're a threat. They're even forced to donate kidneys, livers, and sometimes hearts. And when I say donate, a heart donation is pretty much your last trick. By 2008, there were 3,000 people killed who belonged to that religion. The Communist Party knows that spiritual teachings are a threat to state power. And the religion of wokeism is a threat to this state. And holy wars, which this is, don't have an off switch. When you're arguing with someone who joined a social media mob, you're not arguing with a rational person. You're arguing with every single human being who's ever wronged them. Their abusive dad, their drug addicted mom, all the failures they've ever had, everything that's ever gone horrible in their lives. And believe me, Bernie, as much as he's favored by people who behave that way, they'll toss him on his ass in a second. In a second, the minute he can't make up for a horrible childhood or a lifetime of laziness or professional failure or depression or failed relationships or feeling of powerlessness or addiction. This is the danger of toxic rhetoric, of demonization, of dehumanization, of radicalization. You weaponize people's feelings in a way that rationality stands no chance. And you know who knew that better than anybody? Barack Obama. So Barack Obama knew that this grassroots power could not be controlled. There's a brilliant article in the New Republic, which is a very left-wing publication, called Obama's Lost Army. by the end of his campaign, Obama had 13 million email addresses, 3 million donors, and 2 million active members on his website, including 70,000 people who had their own fundraising pages. They were raising money on his behalf. There was absolutely no reason he couldn't mobilize a huge movement, a grassroots movement. The problem with grassroots movements is they can't be controlled. They won't produce the results the party wants. The party wants money and it wants votes and it wants to win seats. And they want a little bit of something for themselves. When you mobilize a bunch of idealists in a zealous, dogmatic campaign, you don't get that at all. You get something independent and something scary that you can't control. There was a proposal on the table to create an alternative to the DNC. And Obama had the opportunity to take all of these grassroots people and activate them and create this bottom-up political force, this army full of energy, full of radical revisions to whatever it is that we were doing. It was a citizens' movement. And it was killed. It was killed with extreme prejudice. And I encourage you to read the article. I'm going to provide the quote. It is phenomenal. This force that we've unlocked post-Obama cannot be controlled. The crisis narratives, they're all working. And crisis narratives always kind of work. You know, it's like, I think Biden was the one who said Romney wants to put black people back in chains. You know, so this rhetoric is not new. You know, there's all kinds of history here. But crisis narratives work especially well when people are this dogmatic and this emotional. And you know it's serious because rich guys are running scared. I said in the billionaires episode how the best rich people could hope for is to negotiate the terms of their surrender. It's actually happening. Since I did that episode, a bunch of rich billionaires, as opposed to poor billionaires, you know, ones who, you know, their money's kind of locked up. It's not cash available. Anyway, a bunch of them signed a request saying tax us more, which is essentially them saying, hey, this thing's getting out of hand. So we're willing to give you our money or some of our money just so we can negotiate the terms of our surrender. They're not quite surrendering. They're looking to control that narrative. But I don't think in these times it's going to work. And then recently CEOs came up with some half-baked letters saying, oh, we're not just about shareholder value. We care about social issues. Meanwhile, they put nothing on the table saying, oh, this is what we're going to do about it, or here's what we're going to sacrifice, or here's how we're going to fund it. None of that. It was just half-baked, half-hearted phoniness, like fake wokeness that isn't going to work anymore. People see through it, especially the people who are activated and protesting. And there's another brilliant piece I'm going to link to called Delegitimization of a Nation. And this is really what I fear most. This is pretty wild. The New York Times created an entire series of articles, which is similar to all of the radical thinkers I've been talking about before. And the core argument is that anything good that's ever happened in America can be attributed to slavery. And this is a rewriting of history. Now, no one is denying the horrors of slavery or that slavery shouldn't be taught as a huge part of our history or we shouldn't continue to right those wrongs, whether it's through reparations or other approaches that better deal with today's problems. My main issue is with making a crime the core defining characteristic of American identity. We shouldn't be defined by our worst moments, whether you're talking about Germany and the Holocaust, Turks and the Armenian genocide, or the US and slavery. There was a lot of hypocrisy in our history. There was a lot of unfairness, to say the least. There was oppression, there was hardship, there was cruelty, there was abuse, there was all kinds of things. No nation is founded cleanly, ever. Very rarely. I mean, there may have been one that, you know, someone created and said, Belgium, who cares? You know, but I'm kidding, Belgium. There's a lot of things we need to change, but we need to also look for the good, the things that we've been able to achieve within this construct, the democracy, voting for women, the liberation of slaves, all of these things hard fought, and they challenged the system, and things almost broke down, civil war. We're the only country in history that built up our enemies, didn't rape and pillage them. We built Japan, we built up Germany, we built up Italy. It's unprecedented. There is a goodness here. This country gives more in charity than any other in the world. It takes more legal immigrants than any country in the world. And those immigrants come here still. I'm one of them. But to rewrite history this way is a dead end, in my opinion, and in a lot of other people's opinion, who are probably going to be called all kinds of names. Because now you're delegitimizing the core existence of the nation. Because how can something based in horror exist? It can't. Canada's doing the same thing. Before every meeting, they're supposed to, I forgot which province or if it's the whole country, but they have to say something called, it's a land acknowledgement pledge, which is like the Pledge of Allegiance, but basically it says, we attacked and stole this land and we don't deserve it. Forcing the repetition of this pledge turns Canada into a criminal state, something that shouldn't exist on this planet. If you repeat these narratives often enough and you seep them into classrooms, as the New York Times plans to do, they've already created a classroom curriculum on it. In that process, you're replacing one ideology that was flawed of the founding fathers being these holy saints that are untouchable with another one, which is one that says the evils of slavery are responsible for everything. What if neither one is right? We're not leaving a lot of room for nuance here. And some really powerful forces are pushing this delegitimization. And in the bonus episode for Patreon subscribers, I play clips of politicians pushing this idea into people's consciousness. When you make the darkness the core narrative of a country, that's the path to lose your legitimacy, your hopefulness, and sight of the light that you're aiming for. And then you suddenly stop wondering why all these conservatives are clinging to their guns and they're trying to do all these tricks to hang on to power, because they see what's coming. So I'll leave you with a couple of things. I saw Trumpism coming back in my book in 2011, end of 2011 it came out. And I talked about it at the CFO conference, which I'll dig up the video. I saw inequality building. I saw our need to rethink consumption. I was right about those things. I was talking about them long before anyone else was. In fact, I remember having this dinner before that event, before the CFO event, with a woman who's a friend of mine. She's great, but she lives in the suburbs of Boston. And she asked me, well, what's your talk about? I said something like, oh, about all of this unsettlement and all of this rage that's building underneath the country. And she looked at me like I was an alien. I would have had a less severe look if I had just farted and walked away because that's the look I got. And she didn't see it at all because she was living in a suburban bubble and enjoying life. And honestly, I'm a little jealous because I wish I was living in that bubble. But we can't afford the bubble anymore. Reality is, most of us agree on the diagnosis. There's a lot of inequality. Capitalism has become a bit crony. Healthcare is completely messed up. There's a lot of things that need work. The question becomes, can we do this? Can we fix this within our system? Or do we have to topple the whole system? And for all the people that are having this revolutionary orgasm, you have no idea what that means. You have no idea where this rhetoric goes. It is not a place you're equipped to handle. It isn't. You don't want that. I did semi-sarcastically, I did an episode on the Trumpocalypse where I talked about the different levels of preparation that are needed depending on the emergency. You're not prepared. Trust me, you are not prepared. So we've unlocked this powerful weapon. None of us know how to use it. The social media is a nuke. We were not meant to communicate with all of these people, to live in a community of everybody. We were not meant to know anything about what's going on in India. We were not meant to know everything that's going on in China. We were not meant to know. We were meant to live in a group, in a little village, and spear some fish, you know, shit in the woods, bury it, and move on. We're exceeding our expectations. But we can't take it away anymore. We can't take social media from people. We have to become better. We have to learn how to use it, just like you would use a gun or a nuke or whatever heavy equipment I don't know the names of in the military. Because if we don't, we're not nearly prepared for what's coming. Because what's coming is deep fake technology, videos that you cannot trust because they sound and look exactly like people with authority. I talked about that in the last episode. And all of the people producing them will have some sort of agenda. So if we can't handle this nonsense, I don't know what we can handle. And each of us has a choice. You can live a perfectly good life by wiping these ideas from your memory. Delete this episode, walk away, pretend like none of this ever happened. And hopefully you and maybe your kids won't be affected, but I think they will. A lot of the changes that are being made are permanent. Laws are being passed. Companies are changing policies. Rules of our game are being modified. The Overton window is narrowing. Idiocracy is being built right under us, and we are complicit in it. And this cycle will keep happening until the number one TV show is ass, which I think what it was on Idiocracy. We are opening the door to authoritarianism, and you already hear it in the narratives of people like Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris isn't like Elizabeth Warren. She's not coming up with all these policy ideas and whatever. She's like, oh, if you don't do this, I will sign an executive order to take your guns. I'll sign an executive order that everyone gets healthcare. She is signing executive orders, and you know what? Everyone's applauding. Oh, Kamala, yeah, we love your executive orders. That's not a democracy anymore. Just because you agree with what she wants to do or the sentiment, you cannot sign up to the method. That is what principle means. And the ultimate counterbalance to incumbent power structures are individuals. It's not government. Yes, government should be an important check and balance against corporate power and other abuses against individuals and their rights. But ultimately, it's the individual and individuals getting together to achieve great things. But the great things left to achieve are economic, and they're going to involve and require a lot of common sense. That's not where we're going with this. We're not erring on the side of liberty or common sense. We're erring on the side of collectivism and the dumbest version available. We need to inoculate ourselves. That's the only solution. Critical thinking. And not what we call education today. Most important is we need to take this thing down a few notches. We need a giant de-escalation of our rhetoric. We need to be humane to each other. And we can't look at people through the lens of groups that divide us. I know it looks like they bring us together, but they don't, because each group becomes its own separate special interest. They're not uniting us. And the more people we allow to manipulate groups and form mobs and to take people down, the more we're opening the door to totalitarianism. And I know that sounds dramatic, but hopefully I've made my case. Focus on economics. Focus on root causes. Look within first. Don't attack people. Seek to understand them. And we need to decouple people and their ideas. We can't discard whole people. We have to give them a road to redemption. We have to have forgiveness for everybody and find the good and find the value in whatever it is that they have to offer. I'm Steve Factor. That's it for this episode. Don't forget to check out the bonus episode for Patreon subscribers only. I think you'll enjoy it. And if you enjoyed this, share it with others, review it on iTunes. I could use the extra boost. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week or in 5 minutes as you get the bonus episode on Patreon.